back to another edition of the Locked On Wizards podcast. Ben Standing here along with our guy, Adam Rubin from truthaboutit.net. You, of course, can follow. You can find all the podcasts on iTunes. You can follow me on Twitter at Ben Standing. Adam is at Liddell's Place. You can find my work on NBC Washington and FanDrag Sports. He is with truthaboutit.net. We've got a lot to talk about here, Adam. Obviously, the big news, Aaron Rodgers has been cleared by the Packers. Oh, wait, sorry. I don't mean that. You got the Ohtani guy, the Japan import, signing with the Angels. Apparently, he's got an elbow issue. Oh, wait, that's the wrong podcast. Something else happened big tonight in this country, but, well, that's not for us either. The big story, the Washington Wizards once again lost to a bad team. And they did it again late with craziness. The starters largely stunk, and weird things happened at the end of the game, and this is becoming uncomfortably weird, Adam. What is it, like many a first date I've had?
I'll leave that alone. I won't delve into that.
The basics for those who maybe didn't see it. Wizards lose. Final score here: 103-98. We'll get to the end in a second with particularly this potential game-tying three-point attempt that never actually got off because of a five-second call. But let's just go to the bigger picture here with a couple things. So they end this five-game road trip with back-to-back losses to teams with – look, it's on the road. It's, you know, no road game is easy. I'll concede that, of course. But they go back-to-back losses to teams missing not just some players, missing their best players. And I understand the Wizards are missing John Wall, who, by the way, may be back in time. It sounds like maybe back for Wednesday's game against Memphis. I get that the Wizards are missing John Wall, but the Wizards are also considered to be a contender in the East, and the teams that they were playing, the Clippers, over the weekend, the game you saw live, you know, they're missing a bunch of guys, including Blake Griffin. They're falling apart. And the Nets, God bless them, they're scrappy and all that, but they're no D'Angelo Russell, no Jeremy Lin. They just traded away Trevor Booker. When they did the intro for the game on television, Steve Buckhant said, and the Wizards are going to take on Spencer Dinwiddie and the Nets, okay? Right there, that should be a win. They lost. And why did they lose? They couldn't make any threes, but more to the point, the starters, other than Beal for the most part, just didn't give them much of anything, and Scott Brooks was clearly annoyed with them. Basically didn't play three of them in the fourth quarter at all. Once again, Adam, the starters are just not up to the task here these last few games.
Yeah, and I think you can look at Markieff played 19 minutes, Gortat played 18 minutes, and Tim Frazier played 16 minutes.
They combined eight seconds combined in the fourth quarter. And that was
right.
That was just Gortat eating for the last play, which didn't work out, basically, for the game.
Yeah, so clearly Scott Brooks is responding to what he's seeing on the court and changing the playing time accordingly. If you look at, again, plus and minus is not an exact science, but the entire starting five is a minus, all of them in double digits minus, and the entire bench is a plus. And, you know, each individual player is a plus. And, again, I think what you're seeing is the bench playing much better, playing with a lot more effort. But, I mean, looking at the bigger picture, I mean, the starters were not playing with any energy at all. And that's why I think the bench came in and Brooks kept them in the fourth. They were scrappy. They were playing hard. Jason Smith was in there. He was taking charges, more charges than I've seen, you know, anyone else take on this team, you know, for a long time. And Oubre was back to playing with energy and effort. And Satoransky was moving the ball well, and they were getting things going. But I think the biggest issue was the starters throughout the entire game. Their pick and roll defense was just atrocious, and they continue to switch on every pick. Even before the pick is set, the big man jumps onto the guard. I mean, even if there was a possibility of the guard fighting through it and staying on his man, they're still switching. And all game, the big man was rolling, and there was no weak side rotation. So Brooklyn was getting easy baskets at the rim with Jarrett Allen, with everybody scoring at the rim. All they had to do was feign a pick or do a weak pick, and Washington was conceding a mismatch and not rotating at all and protecting the rim. And that's why Brooks got Gortat out early and kept him out, because he was pissed off at the lack of the rim protection. And that was an entire game, the slow rotation, giving up open baskets. And that only stopped once the bench came in and once Jason Smith came in and they actually hustled. And, I mean, there was one play. They were getting killed on that all night, but there's one play with about 3 minutes left when the game was getting close where they actually switched on a pick and roll, but then the weak side, I think it was auto-rotated. He broke up the pass to the big man. It was the first time all game they all hustled all five together. And that's what they were doing when they were winning earlier in the year. You know, when they play well is when they're all five hustling and playing on a string on defense. And they did it for one play, and that was it. And so, that's really where I think the issue is. I mean, it's just a ridiculous lack of effort on defense. I mean, Markieff's not moving. They have no rim protection. Tim Frazier gets destroyed when they switch when he's in, and hopefully that's going to end tomorrow. But
Here's some post-game quotes here from Scott Brooks. Quote, "I thought our guys off the bench did a great job competing. We have to get more from our starters, bottom line. Our starters have to come in and give us effort." And that really is the story. I mean, it was this way the whole game. I mean, in the first quarter, the Wizards are down 30-22. The bench comes in, and immediately they get it back to basically a tie game. We go into the halftime. It's a tie game. And it was, you know, immediately in the third quarter, same thing, right? The starters give up. It was getting to a point I thought the Wizards were going to get blown out. I think they were down, 14 points or something in the third quarter. And then, slowly but surely, basically it was some combination of Bradley Beal, Satoransky, Jody Meeks, Jason Smith, with Oubre, Mike Scott. Those guys, basically some combination of those guys, really, turn this around. But let's get to the late fourth quarter here, because I'll try to do this in somewhat chronological order, because there's a few things here to go through, Adam. And let's not lay this 100% on the players, because I'm going to start with this, and I don't have the exact time here, but about 6 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, the Wizards... it's like a tie game, right? Hold on. I know this is terrible. Oh, here we go. 6:17 to go in the fourth quarter. The Wizards are down one. He brings Beal in for Satoransky, okay? Now, that in and of itself doesn't sound like a bad move, right? Bradley Beal's coming in. But it meant Bradley Beal and Jody Meeks were the backcourt. Now, I had looked this up prior to the game, and it's one of those stats where some people are like, what the hell does a two-man combination mean? But when you look at the Wizards' two-man lineups out there, since John Wall's been out for these last nine games, any lineup that's played, I think it's at least 15 minutes, the worst net rating of any of them is Bradley Beal and Jody Meeks. It hasn't worked. This no point guard lineup hasn't worked. Now, the Wizards were fortunate that Brooklyn decided to follow their inept offense, but basically neither team scored for 4 minutes in this stretch, and then by the time they put Satoransky in, the Wizards did get, the Wizards basically never found their rhythm again. I understand the need to sit Satoransky at some point because he had played a lot, but it just felt like it was taking way too long to get him back in, especially at that point in the game. Your offense is not moving. Why he keeps going to that, and like I said, he's down John Wall. He doesn't have a ton of options. You mentioned Frazier, he's a liability on some level in the fourth quarter because he can't shoot and he's small to defend. So I get, where is he going to go? But that combination hasn't been working, and he put himself in that position late in that game. Just seemed like a bad spot to do that.
Yeah, and when he brought Satoransky in, it was after Beal was playing point, made a ridiculous pass that got stolen by DeMar Carroll, and then Beal fouled Carroll while he was driving for a layup. He got the basket and the foul. And if you want to give Brooks credit, he immediately put Satoransky in for Beal. So, I mean, I'm giving him credit for recognizing that his prior decision was wrong. You know, sort of like giving Ernie Grunfeld credit for dumping Andrew Nicholson, but without, you know, blaming him for the signing in the first place. They've done it. I thought when Avery Bradley was on Beal as a point guard and just humiliated him when they played Detroit, you know, a few games ago, I thought that was going to be the end of the Bradley Beal point guard experiment. But he's continued to do it, and it doesn't work. Now, I will say, I think that at the end of the fourth quarter, I think you hit on this, it was more about him not wanting to put Tim Frazier back in the game than him wanting Bradley Beal to be the point guard, because Satoransky had played so many minutes. The team had been playing so well that he needed a break. So I think it's the fact that Brooks has absolutely no faith in Tim Frazier, as evidenced by the fact that after starting the first half and then the second half, Frazier did, when he came out of the game, he was never put back in the half. Even in the second quarter, Brooks went with a no point guard lineup. He let Beal play point guard in the second quarter rather than put Frazier back in the game. But yeah, in those moments, I mean, Satoransky was fine. He hadn't played that many minutes. What? He didn't play that many for the whole game. So, you know, he's in the 20s. So they definitely would have been better off having Satoransky in as a safety valve. And that turnover killed him with Beal. And it's predictable. And it happens every single time Beal plays point guard. And luckily, with Wall coming back, it's going to stop.
Right. And look, I mean, like you said, I mean, Satoransky played a bunch in the second half. You know, Jody Meeks played 26 minutes, and he was a plus 17. Like you said, plus minus, of course, always a little bit, you know, tough to gauge. But he, you know, at a very basic level, let's just put aside, is he a good defender? He only was 2 for 9 from the field. But Jody Meeks, like the other guys off the bench, was hustling. There was one sequence when he, like, got inside, missed a shot, put up his own, tapped up his own miss, missed again. But then I think Gortat came in and cleaned it up. And but, you know, he was doing the hustle plays. Oubre had 12 and 9, Jason Smith 9 and 5, Mike Scott 8 and 5, Satoransky 8 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. Once again, 0 turnovers. So, you know, we basically have reached a point where, for now, other than Beal and sometimes Otto, Brooks is just simply going with guys who are putting up energy, irregardless of what else is happening. And I don't blame him because of the limited stuff that's going on with the front court. All right, so let's spin this ahead. So the Wizards get a lead, and they're up 98-97. The Nets come out of a timeout with 51 seconds left. You know, the downside of using your bench guys, in theory, it means you don't have your better players on the court. And whether it would have been a different story if Markieff Morris was on the court or not, I can't say. But what happened was, basically, Alan Crabb went to set a pick on Jason Smith, and the Wizards were clearly switching. He went to set a pick on Jason Smith, but instead of setting one, he sort of brushed off of Jason Smith's shoulder, went behind him up to the top of – he did this sort of on the right wing. He went up behind him and then up to the top of the key. Jason Smith, I guess, not recognizing that the bump was, in essence, should have been a sign for him to switch, didn't. Bradley Beal, who was chasing Crabb, did switch. The ball got swung over for Dinwiddie, passed it to Crabb, a wide open three. He buries it to put them up. It was a crucial defensive blunder for the Wizards. Look, Jason Smith clearly missed it. I give him a slight pass because the play was happening, in essence, behind him, and I don't know if he realized it was a fake pick as opposed to somebody just bumping him, but clearly he didn't move, and that cost him a wide open shot there.
I have an issue with this in terms of blaming Smith. You know, I've watched the play a few times, and the pick was really – there wasn't a pick, and it was behind him. And so I don't see why he is responsible for – he didn't know there was any contact until Alan Crabb pushed him in the back. It wasn't a pick. Beal might have assumed there was going to be a pick, but – he didn't get picked, and so I don't know. I mean, that's one of the issues I have with a constant switching as a normal of a defensive philosophy, is to always switch, because you don't always know. You have to wait for the pick to happen before you switch. And what the Wizards do is they anticipate the picks, and this is what they were doing on the pick and roll. They just automatically switch when a pick is about to come, and that's why Beal just assumed there was a switch, even though no pick actually came. You know, Beal was just, I released my man, he's about to set a pick, so now I'm going to switch on to Jason Smith's man. So I think that's part of the problem with having switches that are just done automatically and not saying, hey, fight through it, because there wasn't an actual pick here. So I don't know. I'm giving Jason Smith the benefit of the doubt here that he couldn't have known that pick was coming, or couldn't have known that Beal was anticipating a pick and known to just immediately run with Crabbe. Again, you have to watch the video, and we're talking about a video that you're not watching while we're saying it, but it wasn't a clear-cut play, but yes, it was a defensive. Anytime someone's wide open for a three-pointer, someone, you know, made a mistake they did not execute. But
right. No, I think we're both on the same general page. Because it was happening behind him, he doesn't know. I mean, unless he's got eyes in the back of his head, he doesn't know if Crabbe is setting the pick and therefore he's got a switch, or if it's just somebody just bumping behind him, because which happens. He obviously assumed the ladder didn't move. Beal stayed, so two guys were there, left a wide-open shot. They suffered. So Beal then, on the next possession, misses a shot for the Wizards. The Nets come down. They also miss a shot, but yet here's the next miscue for the Wizards. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson sneaks in to get the rebound. I think the ball even hit the ground. I don't think he got it, like, clean out of the air. And basically, if you watch the replay, Otto Porter was on him. He had interior position, and he basically just let the ball basically, like, bounced away, and basically he just let Hollis-Jefferson out-hustle him to get the ball, which let the Nets kept possession, and that ultimately set them up after a timeout. Spencer Dinwiddie hit one of two free throws to give them a three-point lead, but basically that was another lapse there for Otto. Do we need to talk about that, or just go on to the wacky 3-point or the wacky 5-second call?
Well, I will say one quick thing, because this is the point of why Brooks is playing his bench. On that last play where Washington missed the rebound, Satoransky was switched onto Jared Allen and under the basket. And what he did was he just face guarded Jared Allen and pushed him away from the basket, which is what you need to do. You need to find a man when you're covering a 7-footer, face guard him and just push him the hell out of there if you're caught down there and you're short. So it's those types of little hustle plays which Otto didn't do. Just letting you see Satoransky face guarding a guy with all of his might while Otto Porter's just standing there. So I think that's just sort of a microcosm of the type of energy that Brooks is looking for. Just the little things. Just get out there and just do something. Get on a body. Same thing with Gortat against the Clippers when DeAndre Jordan pushed him the second to last play. Brooks said, look, yeah, he pushed him off, but you got to be a man down there and you got to fight. So I think it's those little things that Brooks is looking for.
All right, so now we get to the really crazy part of it all. This was, you know, what you witnessed in L.A. the other day that we talked about with that clock situation. That was just weird and confusing, in part because of what happened with the refs. But maybe, as you said at that point, you know, and I think my guy Bobby Bankrupt did also, it looked like Beal maybe didn't get the shot off in time regardless. So whatever happened, we really can't blame the refs ultimately for that. What happened here, what we're about to describe, is a much worse scenario, because this is about fundamentals for the Wizards. This is about whatever – unfortunately, there were no – quotes from Brooks or the players that I could see here post-game that I was given that show me what any thoughts on this play. So we're just gonna have to go with what we saw and what we assume. The Wizards have the ball, 8.8 seconds left, side out of bounds, Satoransky on the inbounds. The first thing, you know, we're watching the play, you're watching the ball, of course, and all of a sudden you see the ref counting 1, 2, 3, 4 5. Satoransky sort of throws it on the 5, but I think in fairness, it probably maybe did go that tick after the ref dropped the hand for a 5. Even Steve Buckhantz, who constantly complains about refs and 5-second calls, even he said that the count seemed fair. So the whistle goes on Satoransky. You're like, unbelievable. How does he not get the ball in, right? But then I go back and immediately watch the play, and I think you've now done that as well. And the bizarre part is the play design, or at least the execution of it. Because what happens is you've got Bradley Beal sort of on the low block opposite side of the court from Satoransky. They need a 3. Otto Porter starts the motion. He cuts immediately around to the basket as if maybe hypothetically Satoransky would throw a quick pass to him for a layup. Or if nothing else, maybe you're hoping the defense focuses on him. Kelly Oubre kind of follows behind him. that with leaving Beal and Gortat as only two players on that side of the court. Gortat is essentially foul line extended. Looks like he's standing there, assuming that Beal will run towards him to set a pick. But Beal doesn't even move until, like, the count, the 5-second count is, like, around three. By the time he moves, gets in the vicinity of Gortat, then gets to the top of the arc, it's basically right there on just, a, you know, just a, about four and change count. So Satoransky throws it when he sees the guy come open, but by then it's too late. And so, therefore, the question is, what the hell was going on here? Did somebody miss a pick and not help set Beal free earlier? Or is Beal's internal clock, one that maybe was off in L.A., is it proven to be broken because he waited way too long to move on this? And by the way, the worst part is he actually made the shot when he caught the inbounds pass, which would have tied the game, but it didn't count.
Yeah, this is a tough one because, first of all, yes, Buchan says the 5-second call was fair, meaning that it actually was 5 seconds, but it's not fair in that they never call it at 5 seconds. It was about 5.2 seconds, 5.3, but they never call it that fast. But aside from that, Beal, not only does he not move for over 3 seconds, his first movement is to take 2 steps into the lane before attempting to body slam. Was it Hollis Jefferson? I forget who was, you know, to get free.
And so he really did, by the way. He really almost threw the defender to the ground. It wasn't like he just bumped into him. He really, it looked more like a football play than it did a basketball play. He really aggressively tried to get away from him and almost threw him to the ground.
And that's because there was about 4 seconds that already elapsed at the play. You know, it was LeVert who he did it to, but about 4 seconds had already elapsed, so he had to do that in order to get, you know, free. But so you have Beal not getting free until after 5 seconds, and second, because you might think, well, wait a minute, maybe Satoransky was zeroing in on Beal, and you know, he shouldn't have waited to Beal; he should have passed it to a secondary option. At the time that Beal comes free, Oubre and Gortat are setting picks facing the basket, not looking at Satoransky. There's not even an option, you know, for the ball to be passed in. Otto Porter, who after that curl, he curled towards Satoransky, but then all the way, you know, sort of a circular motion all the way back towards the other side of the court. And if you see, he wasn't even available for a pass. He after his curl, he just sort of stopped under the basket. So there was nobody for Satoransky to pass it to. And this is where we get to the play design. There's now 5 seconds have elapsed. There is not one player on the court who Satoransky can pass it to. Not one. I mean, how does that happen? So, again, that's why we wanted the quotes at post-game to figure out what happened. Something went wrong. I don't know if somebody was supposed to set a pick for Beal so he wouldn't have to body slam his man, but it doesn't look like it because Oubre and Gortat were sort of making a wall at the foul line. It looked like that was going to be where Beal was supposed to run to. So, you know, I don't know if Brooks drew up the play and forgot how long it takes for human beings to actually run those motions before the Beal would come up to the top of the key. But it was very strange, and it's unfortunate. But I know from talking to Satoransky after the Clippers game, when he passed it into Gortat, he said he has the 5-second clock in his head and he knows it was getting close. And it was in that game too, getting very close. So he's aware of the time and he knows how long 5 seconds are. And nobody was there for him to pass it to. And we really do need to hear some type of explanation from Scott Brooks, because this did not make any sense at all. And by that, I mean, you need to be going to shoot around tomorrow and getting us an explanation.
Alas, there is no shoot around. The Wizards will fly in tonight, and I guess, you know, take the morning off, which is
well. Then go to pregame. Don't get me on a technicality. You need to be there pregame 5:15. I want you tweeting out the explanation.
I will work on that. I mean, I would presume that it was asked postgame. It just was not included in the quotes. I'm trying to see looking online to see if I can find anything. In any event, so Brooklyn made 2 free throws after that, and that was. That was the ball game. So the Wizards are now at 14-13. They finished this road trip at 2-3. You know, look, if you typically say, and they're now 4-5 without John Wall. I know that in the grand scheme of things, if somebody who had heard John Wall was going to be out, and John Wall would have missed nine games, and assuming nine games, assuming he's back tomorrow, if somebody who just generally pays attention to the league, know John Wall, what's the Wizards' record, they probably would say, losing record, right? I had somebody tell me, who I'll remain nameless, but somebody who pays attention, said they may not win a single game without him, which I, of course, laughed in their face. But in any event, a losing record, if I, 4-5, you might be like, maybe, I don't know, 2-3 on any road trip, even though this was not a particularly, the opponents weren't exactly amazing. And they did have a 47-point loss in this road trip, but they easily could have won all four other games. Ultimately, 4-5 without Walt, this is what it is, and 2-3 is ultimately disappointing because of how these last two games ended. I mean, let's not even forget, they lost before they went away. They lost the Portland game, right? I mean, the Utah game, as horrible as it was, blowouts happened, so we can almost sort of punt that one. But to lose to the Clippers, you're up four with 50 seconds or so left at the free throw line. They blow that. This one, it definitely stings. And, Adam, we've reached now, they played 27 games, which by my math essentially is one-third of the season. We're way past the point of saying things are particularly early. And it's frustrating. I mean, look, at the end of the day, let's end this on a positive note, Adam. Because, like I said, John Wall, we think, is going to be back tomorrow. At least it sounds like he'll be back this week. The Wizards are now going to start a four-game homestand. Here's what I think, though, is maybe the good part of all of this. As bad as this result was and as bad as the last game was, the bench has played much, much better, right? I'm going to assume on some level that the starters will pick up with Wall back, right? Now, I could be wrong, but we would think that would be some logical sense. I can't comprehend. You and I have now talked several times on this podcast and off air about this whole point guard situation. There's no way at this point he can go back to Frazier. He's played Satoransky all fourth quarter, basically, in the last, two or three games. There's no way he can make that switch. He has to stay with Satoransky and have Frazier be the 11th guy. And it is what it is. But, I mean, somebody has to sit. There's no way. And if that's the case, if he stays with Satoransky and the bench, somehow doesn't revert to the weirdness it's had earlier in the year and, of course, last year, the benches look good, and now if the starters get back to some form of normalcy, the Wizards actually might be really good. I'm not ready to say that will be the case because they're so wildly inconsistent. I'm just saying the bench has been something of a revelation with that Wall, and you have to imagine Brooks is going to want to keep this going, and that would mean Satoransky along with the other four guys. Jan Mahimi didn't play today with a knee issue. We'll see about tomorrow. Jason Smith did play. I'm talking about with Mahimi and not Jason Smith, even though Jason Smith was active tonight. He did things. But either way, you have to think Satoransky's going to stay.
Well, look, I have 58 games of Trey Burke, which says there's always a possibility that Tim Frazier will stay there. The only bright spot, the only hope, is that he played Satoransky again in the fourth, but also that, as I said earlier, he did not put Frazier back in at the end of the second quarter. So it was just a one-and-done type thing for Frazier. Start the first, start the second half, and you're done. So, you have to assume that, but, he's been very slow to change up, rotations, and this would be a pretty big deal because this is going to be DNPs for Tim Frazier. He's going to be back in Satoransky's position. And I could see the only justification he gives in letting Frazier still be the backup point guard is what he said, when I asked him the question before the Clippers game is, Satoransky can play shooting guard and small forward, so it isn't even an either-or question. You could have them both on the court at the same time. So my concern is still that he would view Frazier as the backup point guard and just try to find other ways to get Satoransky on the court, maybe for Meeks, and maybe when they go small, if Markieff's going to still be benched. So, I mean, there's still ways that he can do it.
But realistically, I get what you're saying, but I'm just saying if you look at the other components, Mike Scott, he didn't go crazy today, but Mike Scott's been fantastic for the most part of late. Kelly Oubre, he's been certainly more up and down of late. His shooting is going back to sort of closer to where it was a year ago, but he brings energy. He's not going to sit, right? He's going to have at least one big man out there, whether that's Jan Mahimi, I presume, or Jason Smith. And Jody Meeks is the one other guy who can shoot. So there's literally, it's not like he could say, well, I could have Frazier and Satoransky, but then this guy will sit. Who's going to sit? There's literally nowhere else. I'm with you. Anything could happen. But I will be apoplectic at this point if he doesn't do it. What else does he have to see to not go with it?
Well, here, this is the only reason why. First of all, if you'll be apoplectic, think of how I will be. But what I would say is this. Satoransky was better than Tim Frazier every single game of the year this year, even as Satoransky sat at DMPs. And I'm positive that he was showing that in practice as well. So he's showing it now with Wall injured. But just think of the fact that, forget the first 20 games when Wall wasn't injured. We were playing Tim Frazier ahead of Satoransky. And so that's why I'm saying it's like there is this sort of like block when the coaches and the front office talk about Satoransky every single time. He's a shooting guard. He's a small forward. He can do other things. So, but yes, it's obvious that the second unit plays better. I think one of the reasons why the offense is struggling with the starters is because Tim Frazier is playing with them. It is such a big drop-off. I think if Satoransky was playing with the starters right now, they'd be doing a lot better. Of course, the bench would be worse with Frazier, but I'm just saying a lot of it is the Frazier drop-off, the fact that he's not versatile at all. You can't play defense, especially when they switch. But, yes, I would assume Satoransky is going to be the starter, the backup point guard. That is a big deal going forward because if they can get that bench production, which they've had, and it's the team has sort of taken on it's almost like the embodiment of like Kelly Oubre. It's like what the team is in that we're seeing what they could be. They show flashes and you just say, look, if they could just be consistent, if they could just stop blowing these leads, they'd be 15-6 by now. It's almost like that mentality where you can see what's there. You can see what's out there, but they just can't put it together. But the hope is, of course, that the starters have done it for several years now. Let's get it together and let's start playing some complete games. But, these collapses happen when you can't put it on Wall's out. They were a game under 500. That's great. But they were making these same blown games when Wall was playing. So it's not absolutely. just Wall will come back. So that's the concern. It's not like Wall comes back, everything's fine because now our bench is good, But they all have to get their act together and start playing better. But yes, I'm hoping tomorrow it'll be. It's going to be a tense moment, 9 minutes into the game, when Scott Brooks, makes that call to put in the backup point guard because that's going to be a huge, huge decision because that's the difference between DMPs and the possibility of becoming an actual real rotation player for Satoransky.
Yeah. I'm looking.
You're looking for extra quotes?
No. I'm looking back here. I think that Tim Frazier can be effective in some spots. I just think look, in part, is Tim Frazier responsible for Markieff Morris? Martin Gortat is not playing that great right now. I don't think so. He's not controlling their energy. I think Tim Frazier can keep the trains moving. Like I said before, though, when he's on the second unit, and they don't have any guys. They have guys who need to be set up more. That's where the issue is. So, I'm looking back here I'm trying to find here some. I was looking back some scout I was dealing with back in the day or over the summer when they acquired Frazier, and looking back and he was like, meh on Frazier, the revolving door at backup point guard. Continues. I had other people tell me they like them, and I guess it's like with all these things, it's different watching somebody play here and there as opposed to watching them play on a daily basis. And Tim Frazier had some decent numbers with the Pelicans, but it doesn't even matter. It's less about Frazier on some level, and just more that things are working with Satoransky. It's not saying it's all the bench isn't just about Satoransky. Other guys have done well, but. Anyway, so that would be the silver lining of all this. If the end result of they went 4-5 without Wall, but they found they have a bench in what works, then ultimately you'd have to say this could be a positive stretch, as silly as that sort of sounds in this moment where we're talking about a loss to the Brooklyn Nets. But that's the potential silver lining. We'll just have to see what Scott Brooks does going forward.
Yeah, well, and we'll find out in real soon, too.
Yeah, we will.
Tomorrow night against Memphis.
Will you be at the game?
I will be in attendance. I will be there, and, you know, I'm hoping for my sake and my mental health and the health of everybody around me and my family that Satoransky is the first point guard off the bench tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be awesome when Satoransky comes in, assuming Wall's back and Satoransky comes in. Just a random substitution with like 4 minutes left in the first quarter, you may see a one man standing ovation. It's possible.
Oh, if that were to happen, I can guarantee that there will be at the very least a one man standing ovation.
Oh, good Lord. I root for logic, and there's just the logic is there. But the other part of this equation is, even with the bench playing better, the starters typically play more minutes, of course, and they got to get these guys going. I mean, for Markieff Morris in particular, I mean, Gortat's definitely been a little more up and down, but Markieff Morris in particular, what he provides them is something that they can't get otherwise. You know, Kelly Oubre can do some things, Mike Scott can do some things, but, you know, Cleveland and LeBron are coming in here on Sunday. This is the type of game, that's the game where you need Markieff Morris to be energized. He's going up against LeBron. He's the one guy the Wizards have that can sort of stand up to LeBron physically. We saw what happened in the last game when they didn't really have him. LeBron went for 57. But look, I mean, if you're Scott Brooks, if Markieff doesn't start showing you more, it's going to get harder and harder to play him. And, you know, ultimately there is a question of what's the deal? Is the injury, you know, is there more injury than they've let on? And yada, yada, yada. But, all right, Adam, look, I've kept you here long enough. It's a big night here. There's a lot of things to get to. I'm sure you have work to do and television to watch. So I'll let you go. I appreciate it, man. Adam Rubin on Twitter. He is at Liddell's Place. I'm sure he'll be writing things on truthaboutit.net. Go find him there. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you guys for listening. Of course, you can find me on Twitter at Ben Standig. The podcast is on iTunes, and we are out of here. Until next time, see ya.
Everybody just Neal gets open for three. Dagger!
Bobby Bryant, off-balance shot.
Dagger!
Not ball.